I'm going to give you plenty of time to get to where we're starting today. If you turn into Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. Minor prophets don't get used as much as some of the other texts. They're small and sometimes hard to find. I'll give you plenty of time to get there. Hosea is the first of those minor prophets. It'll be as you end those major prophets with Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah. Hosea will be the first of the minor prophets after Daniel. Glad you're here. Good number here. Avish is with us. Hope you'll come back anytime that you can. Freddie mentioned about the Bible study at the Coolidge tonight, second Sunday night of every month. We get together with the young. Hope you'll come. Parents take advantage of that. This will be the last one before school starts back. We'll be meeting at the Coolidge at 7 o'clock. And the topic tonight is going to be issues that our young are facing. What are some of the issues that they have to deal with? I hope it'll be a good study. Get your kids there if you can. If they need a ride, we'll make sure they get them home. This coming Saturday as well, there's a series of at Anderson. The flyer's back on the back bulletin board. It'll be an all-day thing from about 9 o'clock in the morning on. Carl and I are going to drive Darby over for that. We've got 5 extra seats, so pile them in. If you want your children to go to that, we'll make sure they get there, and we'll get them back that night as well. But take advantage of these opportunities. There are a lot of people here who would like a go-over, like to have a second shot at raising their children. Well, some of us are doing that right now. We have them still in our home. Take advantage of the opportunities that we get. Hosea chapter 4 is where we're beginning. Just to remind us about who Hosea was, he was a prophet to Israel. Very unique situation that he is a prophet of. He knows what he's talking about. He was a prophet whose wife left him and went into harlotry. She sold herself to others. In the course of that, she had several children that were not his. And as she got older and began to age, she's no longer beautiful. She's no longer attractive. She's no longer wanted by those men who came for her. She's put on a slave auction. And Hosea comes back and buys her and takes her back as his wife. Takes those children and raises them as his own. And now he comes to Israel and he talks about unfaithfulness to God. He comes to Israel pleading with them to be faithful to God. He is a prophet who knows what in the world he's talking about. He's a passionate speaker who understands a one-sided relationship. He's one who understands unfaithfulness. He understands helping somebody that probably didn't deserve it, which is exactly what God did to us. Loved us when we didn't deserve it. Willing to take us back through our unfaithful phases. He knows what he's talking about. And with that being in mind, he now comes to them and trying to draw them back. There are some themes that continue to pop up. And by the way, this is not a study of Hosea today. I'm just reminding us who he is so that his message resonates a little bit. As he begins to talk about the destruction that's coming, he's talking to Israel, the ones that Assyria is going to take into captivity. And he's talking to them, trying to get them to repent so that doesn't become their fate. And there are themes that just continually pop up. And one of them is a lack of knowledge. How did Israel get to be where they were if they didn't know who God was? Start with me in verse 1 of chapter 4. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel. The Lord has a controversy with the land. You listen up. God's got a problem with you. What's the problem? There's no truth in this land. There's no mercy in this land. And there's no knowledge of God in this land. You don't know who He is. Now that doesn't mean had you given them a blank piece of paper and said, tell me what God's name is. They would have said Jehovah. They would have known about Israel in the wilderness. They would have known about Moses. Doesn't mean they didn't know who He was. What it means is they don't know who He is. They don't know what He wants. They don't know what He expects. They don't know His character. There's no truth and there's no mercy and there's no knowledge. They don't recognize and obey Him. Verse 5. There is a falling coming. He's warning him. He says, there's going to be a falling. You shall fall in the day, and the prophet, he's talking to those priests, he says, you're the main problem with this. You're the cause of it. And at the end of verse 5, he says, you're going to be destroyed. Hosea is trying to get their attention. There is destruction coming. Verse 6, why is destruction coming? My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. They have rejected knowledge, and I will reject them. You don't know me. You don't know anything about me. Look in verse 5. Chapter 5, verse 4. The theme keeps popping back up. Chapter 5, verse 4. Talking about the destruction to come, and he says, they will not frame their doings to turn to their God. The spirit of whoredoms is in the midst of them. Again, remember, Hosea knows about harlotry. And now he's telling Israel, he says, you're just like my wife. You have gone into harlotry. You sold yourself to others. You're unfaithful to God. The spirit of whoredom is in the midst of them, and they have not known the Lord. They've not acknowledged Him. We'll look at one more. Chapter 6. It's almost as if they throw the question, well, what do you want? What do you expect from us? Verse 6 of chapter 6. Here's what I desire. You want to know what I want from you? Here it is. I want goodness. I want mercy. I don't want your rote sacrifice. I don't want you just going through the motions. I want knowledge of God more than I want your burnt offerings. See, I don't want you to just play games with me. I don't want you to bring the turtle dove, and I don't want you to just bring the lamb because it's the Day of Atonement, and I don't want you to just go to the priest because you got to go to the priest. I want you to know who I am. I want you to appreciate me, and I want you to respect me, and I want you to obey me. That's exactly the phrase that Samuel told Saul when he offered that sacrifice. He had no offer. This is what he told him when he didn't destroy the Amalekites. When those times Saul failed, here's what the message was. I want you to know me. I want you to do what I ask. One last passage. We got a little bit longer introduction today. Turn to Isaiah chapter 1. Let's talk about Judah for a moment. Isaiah was a prophet to Israel during the divided kingdom. Now go back to Isaiah. He was a prophet to Judah after Israel's already fallen. The point is, Israel has already been an example of what happens when you disobey God. The destruction in Israel has already happened. And now after that, another prophet to another nation. Isaiah now talking to Judah. In verse 2, here's how he starts it. Hear, O heavens, and give ear. Listen up. Listen up, O earth. The Lord has spoken, and here's what the Lord said. He said, I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows his owner, the donkey knows where his next meal's coming from, but Israel does not know, my people does not consider. Isaiah's message begins with, even the dumb animals in the field know what barn to go to. They know the hand that feeds them. They know what stall is going to have the food. An animal knows it. But you don't know who I am. You don't know anything about me. And we look at those passages. And by the way, those are clear passages. They're not up for discussion about what God's trying to say. You don't know me. You don't acknowledge me. You don't respect my authority. You don't obey. And we look at those passages and that just sounds incredible. How do they not know who God is? How can they be destroyed for lack of knowledge? Weren't they a nation that was founded by God? Didn't God raise them up? Yes. Weren't they a God that was a nation that was given a law by God, not just a religious law, but just a secular law? Their everyday law of how to deal with people, that was God's law. They had that, right? Yes. Especially the people Isaiah's talking to, Judah, is that not where the Ark of the Covenant was housed? Did they not walk past the temple every day and they don't know Him? We look at that and that just makes no sense. It sounds incredible. Or is it? Turn to Matthew 15. Matthew 15. What I'm asking us is, do we know who He is? Do we have any idea who God is? Do we really know Him? Because Israel did not know Him. Judah did not know Him. And now I want to show us how there's a New Testament example in which history repeated itself. Before we read Matthew 15, I'm going to take us back and give us some history of the Pharisees. We know about the Pharisees very well, but many might not know the history very well. The Pharisees came about in that period of time between Malachi and Matthew, in that intertestament period. They came out about 300 years. Now that was a 400-year period. About 300 years prior to Jesus' coming is when the Pharisees were established. That's the word. It was during the time of the Greek conquering of the world, Alexander the Great, that we're all familiar with, and Greek conquered everything and everybody. And they didn't just conquer you, they brought their stuff with them. Greek culture spread. Their language spread, their art spread, their philosophy spread. And that was true in Judah as well. They brought people in Judah, because of that Greek influence, began worshiping pagan gods. And there was a group of Jews who stood up and said, "We will not do that. Those are foreign. They are pagan. They are ungodly. We are not going to take our identity and match it to them." And they stood up, and the phrase that they used was, they built a hedge around that. "We're not letting that stuff in here." To their credit. By the day of Jesus, by the first century, that group that started 300 years before, they were the largest and most respected religious group in Palestine. There were roughly about 6,000 of them by Jesus' day. And they were looked at as the authority of the law. They were the lawyers of the day. We think of lawyers in a different realm. Lawyers back then was, go to the Pharisees because they know the law of Moses. Go to your questions. Take your religious question to them. They'll know it. Nobody read more than them. Nobody prayed more than them. Nobody fasted more than them. And you all know that there was no bigger thorn in the side of Jesus than they were. The ones who did so much, the ones who were so respected, the ones who knew God. Matthew 15. How was it that they knew God and didn't know who Jesus was? And they actively persecuted Him from the first time they saw Him and heard Him? Matthew 15, verse 1, the Jews that Jesus came to the scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, and they said, "Why do the disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? They wash not their hands when they eat." And by the way, don't start thinking, "Well, those nasty men, how can they not wash their hands?" That's not what this is talking about. This was not washing hands for hygiene. This was a washing of the hands of a religious significance that they were saying was sinful if you didn't. They've taken a custom and they turned it into law. And they're asking Jesus, "Why do you let your people sin?" You know, the tradition of the elders is that we wash our hands. And yet, verse 3, "Why do you transgress the commandments of God by your traditions?" So I got a question for you. You want my disciples to follow your traditions? Well, let me ask you a question. How in the world do you let your traditions violate God's law? Answer that one for me, is what he says. Then he gives them an example about the raca, how they had come up with a loophole of how they got around protecting and providing for parents. And verse 7, the conclusion, "You hypocrites. Isaiah prophesied about you." Isaiah, the same one we just read a while ago. "My people don't know me." Isaiah prophesied well about you, verse 8. He said, "The people will draw nigh to me with their mouth. They will honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they worship me, teaching for doctrine the commandments of men." I'm going to give you one answer. Why did the Pharisees persecute Jesus? They didn't know who God was. Didn't know a thing about Him. Oh, they read more than anybody else. They prayed more than anybody else. They gave more and they fasted more. And by the way, they would have told you that. They didn't know him. And it led to their self-righteousness. And it led to their hypocrisy. And it led to this religious pretense. All lip service. All vanity. History repeated itself. People that should have known God didn't know God. I told you it was a long introduction. Well, now we're here. Could history repeat itself again? Today. In the church. In the 4th Street Church. The lessons of these Old Testament prophets is that yes, me and you can attend every assembly that happens and not know God. That's what Hosea is telling us. Me and you can memorize every verse that our head can hold and we not know a thing in the world about God. That's what Isaiah is telling us. Me and you can know, hear, believe, repent, confess and be baptized and know all the verses to back it up. We can do it forward and backward. And the lesson from the Pharisees is we can still not know who God is. And we can know all about what's wrong with institutional things doing the work of the church. And we can know all about the acts of worship and what belongs and what doesn't belong. We can know all of that and not know God. That's the lesson of Israel. It's the lesson of Judah. And it's the lesson of the Pharisees. Look to 1 John chapter 2. Let's make sure that's right. I made the statement kind of boldly. We can do all this stuff and still not know Him. We need some proof of that. And John is our proof. Israel during Hosea's day, they didn't listen. They hadn't learned. And they were serving a God they really didn't know. So did the Pharisees. And so can we. 1 John chapter 2, verse 4. He that says, I know him, and keeps not his commands, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. Oh, we can say all the right things. We can memorize all the right things. We can say we know him, but that doesn't mean that we know him. Israel would have said the same thing. Judah, you guarantee, would have said the same thing. The Pharisees, it's beyond debate. They would have said they knew God. But they didn't. And that's what John's telling us. We can say it, but if we're not obeying Him, if we don't acknowledge Him and give Him the respect and obedience He deserves, we don't know Him any more than those nations. By the way, Israel destroyed for lack of knowledge. Judah, Babylon rolled for lack of knowledge. The Pharisees, we read about them. You know why? Because we can't go talk to one. Gone. Gone. Lack of knowledge. And me and you have to answer the question, do we know Him? I'm not talking about in some theoretical, oh, His name is Jehovah, and He's the Creator, and He lives in heaven, and He's going to come back and judge, and He had a son named Jesus. Do you know Him? Do you acknowledge Him? Do you obey Him? That was the issues. Those prophets we're trying to deal with. And that's the issues we've got to deal with in our own life. I'm just going to throw some questions out. Very, very familiar. Just kind of just reminders. Everyone, all going to be reminders. But all prefaced with the idea of we better know who we're dealing with. Do we know God? Do we know that He expects our abilities to be used to His purposes? Do we know that? Do we let that get into our head? Look at Matthew chapter 25. We better know who He is because some of the most scary language in the New Testament is found when opportunities and abilities were spit at. We're not going to look at the parable of the talents. We know it. I'm going to remind us of it. I just want to look at the conclusion of it. We'll make sure we know who He is. Master came and gave five here, two here, one there. We know what happened. He went away for however long. Then He came back and He had some accounting to do. Here's what I gave you. What have you done? Here's what I gave you. What have you done? And here's what I gave you. When he came to that one talent man, and just to remind us, he just dug a hole and buried it. You remember that? Verse 18, he that received the one went and dug a hole in the earth and hid it. And that's all he did. Never second thought again. Just when the Lord came and spoke to him, I want you to look at the words he used. And by the way, remember, he put it in a hole. He didn't go to Las Vegas and blow it on wine, women, and song. He didn't go to New Orleans and paint Bourbon Street. That's not what he did. He did nothing, is what he did. Verse 26, his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and slothful servants. Verse 30, he cast the unprofitable servants into outer darkness. Those are some of the scariest words in the English language. Wicked and slothful. You know, you can't pretty that up. You can't sweetheart that away. And you can't oh bless their heart and make that sound any better. Wicked and slothful. Verse 30, there's no way to make unprofitable sound good. Unprofitable means useless. No value. And this was a man that didn't go blow it on drink and drug and women. It's a man who did nothing with the abilities God gave him. Do we know who he is? Do we know that's who we're standing before? He deals with us righteously. One of the most encouraging things to me in this whole parable is taking verse 20 and taking verse 23. Actually, I'm sorry, verse 21 and 23. Just real quick with your mind, just scan down. Look at verse 21 and verse 23. These were the responses to the five talent and the two talent, and they are basically word for word. The second talent man, when he was done, he only had four. But he gets the same praise as the guy that began with more than him. When the second talent man was done, he didn't even have what the other guy started at. And he got the very same praise, word for word. You see, God is righteous. He will only hold us accountable for what we can do. I'm thankful. I've got heroes that preach, and you've got heroes that preach too. And some of us may share the same ones. I'm not going to be held accountable to teach like they teach. It's not how I'm going to be judged. It's not how you're going to be judged. I know we're all thankful for that. But we will be judged by what we can do and what we do with it. And we better know who he is. Because we spend a lot of our time trying to skirt around that. He's going to hold us responsible. And what this one talent guy did, just a Bible class, just what were some of his mistakes? Just he was a man that he was content. He took what he had and dug a hole and didn't do a thing with it, good or bad. Content with doing nothing. He was a man that was inactive. And by the way, that's a nice way of saying lazy. You like laziness? We don't tolerate that very much, do we? That's a character flaw. We don't like it. Do we know who God is? He doesn't like it either. He was fearful. He didn't see the importance of doing what he had and doing the best way. He didn't see any importance of that at all. At the core, the one talent man didn't know who his master was. The one talent man misjudged his Lord. And he had some convoluted idea of, I can just dig this hole and I can do nothing. And when he comes and asks me about it, I'll be able to. I can sweet talk him. I can maneuver. I'll be okay. He didn't have any idea who his master was. Had no idea about what made him up. Had no idea about his character. And I'm asking us, do we know who we're standing in front of? Could it be said that the church has a lot of three-talent people who are wanting to be one-talent people? Removes the responsibility, doesn't it? Could the church be filled with people who say, I can't, when really it's I won't? How does that make us feel? How's that scenario float around? God's given us abilities. God's given us talents to whatever extent. He puts us in position. By the way, by lot and by providence and by where we live, we are together. Now we bind our talents the best that we can. Every one of us responsible for what we do. You teach into your ability? Or like, is it one of those strange situations we get into where the most knowledgeable, the most wise, the most experienced here retire from that? Oh, I'm going to let the young take care of that. We know who the master is. We know what kind of God we're going to stand before. We better use our abilities. And that's the lesson of the one talent man. Slothful, wicked, unprofitable. Let him hang around in our lap a little bit. Do we know who he is? Do we know who he is? Do we know that he doesn't accept excuses? Look in Luke chapter 14. Me and you are excellent excuse makers. A number one excuse makers. We got PhDs in excuse making. If you've read the bulletin yet, that article, that first article in there, obviously a tongue-in-cheek, incredibly out there example. But that was the point he was trying to make, of some of the ridiculous excuses that people can make. And ours obviously won't be as ridiculous as that made-up scenario. But we're still awful good at it. And we better know who we're dealing with. Luke chapter 14 is another parable. Verse 16, a certain man made a great supper and he invited many. Then all of a sudden, once the day came, and he slaughters the animal, and all of a sudden it's time to come. He sends out message. Verse 18. They with all consent began to make excuse. The first one said, I bought a piece of ground. I got to go check it out. Verse 19. Another said, I bought 5 oxen. I got to see if they can plow. I got to go put them to the test. Verse 20. I have a married wife. Can't come. Sorry. Thanks for the invite. Catch you later. Do we remember how this parable plays out? It's not ending in nice language either. It's not ending in fun stuff either. These are the same excuses that we use today. Very same ones. I've bought some land. I got to go check it out. There's your business. There's your proposition. There's our schemes we've got working up in the fires. Here's our business excuse. I'm head to toe in this. I've got to go take care of it. Verse 19, I bought some animals. There's our possessions. Verse 20, I don't know what in the world that's about. I have married a wife. I can't come. There's our family excuse. Business, stuff, and family. And we use them like they're a trump card. We use them like the ace in the hole, and we just throw them out on the table every time something comes up that we don't want to do. And we use this to make it better. It's interesting, the phrasing that is used. In verse 18, it says they all with one consent began to make an excuse. You see, they weren't real. They weren't valid. There is a difference in having an excuse and making an excuse. We know the difference in those two words, right? Sometimes you have dessert ready on the counter. There are other times you get caught unaware. Somebody shows up and all of a sudden you get to scurry around to make one. He didn't say they had an excuse. They began to make one up. They began to just maneuver. They began to manufacture one for the occasion. And what it was, it's just camouflaged lies. Just cut through this. I can't come. I've got to check my land. Well, unless that land was sold by Harry Houdini and it's going to disappear tomorrow. How valid is that? I've got some animals. I got 5 animals. I got to put them to the test. Unless those things were long in the tooth and they're heaving and huffing and they're 2 steps away from death, tell me where they're going to be tomorrow. You know exactly where they'll be tomorrow. And then that third one, I've got a wife. I don't understand that one at all. Unless this is like Hosea's wife and she's about ready to step out on him, what in the world is that got to do with it? I can't come because I'm now married? These are silly. And you know they're silly. But me and you throw some rose color smell on it, and we're doing the same thing. Making the same ones. Excusing our lack of using our abilities. Our lack. We're not using our talents. We're not taking advantage of opportunities. And then we excuse ourselves and we still feel good about it. Do we know who He is? Drop down to verse 24. Those who made those excuses, He said, none of these men that were invited will taste of my supper. So those who I invited and they come up with these lame brain excuses, oh, they'll not be with me. None of them. We know what that means. Excuses are as old as mankind. We didn't invent them. We're just good at it. We didn't invent them. Let me just throw some out and you'll know exactly these situations. He told me it tasted good. He told me it would make me wise. And she gave it to me. I wouldn't have done it on my own. She enticed me. Lord, what will I say? What will I tell them? Who will I say sent me? My tongue doesn't work good enough. I'm not a good enough speaker. Don't send me there. You remember when we studied very recently on Wednesday night? Samuel, you didn't come, buddy. We're about to go into battle. You can't go into battle without offering sacrifice. My men were scared. I forced myself to offer that sacrifice. And the one talent man, oh, I was afraid. I know, I was afraid. Adam and Eve's excuses didn't fly, and we know that. Moses' excuse didn't fly. Saul's excuse didn't. The one talent man's didn't. And the best one me and you have ever come up with to justify what we did do or didn't do, it won't fly either. Because we know who He is, right? We know what kind of master He is. We know what kind of God He is. We know Him. And yet we're all there with, you know, I'm just too young for that. We'll let the older people do it. The older people are saying, I'm too old. I've done my part. I'm on parole now. I'm out. The younger one's going to do that. And I'll do it later. That's when we throw all, well, I'll do it later. And there's a bunch of others. They've never worked. They never will work. And if we don't learn who He is, our fate's going to be Israel's and Judah's and the Pharisees and the one talent man and these excuse makers in verse 24 who says they will never taste of my meat. Never taste of my food. Never taste of my supper. That's talking about spiritual meat of heaven, that eternal home. We won't taste of it. Do you know who He is? Do I know who He is? I'm going to give you one more. We say we know God. Do we know that He doesn't mess around with sin? He doesn't overlook it. Doesn't get conditioned to it. Doesn't tolerate it. Now that's stuff me and you do. We can be guilty of that. But do we know that He doesn't? 2 Corinthians chapter 5, I want to end with this. And by the way, this explains those other ones, doesn't it? Why is it that He expects us to use our talents and abilities? It's because He doesn't tolerate anything else. Why is it that excuses aren't acceptable? It's because He doesn't tolerate it. And here's what we have to know. Bring it all back to Hosea, all back to knowledge. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. We got 10 down. That's a memory verse. But let it flow into verse 11. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to what he has done, whether it be good or bad, knowing therefore the fear of the Lord. Knowing how to fear the Lord then, we persuade men. Can you take that verse and invert it? Put verse 11 on top of verse 10. You know what you got? You got Paul saying, I know who God is. I have a reverential fear for Him. And I know what's going to happen at judgment. Everybody is going to stand in front of Him And everything they've ever done is going to be held to their account that hadn't been forgiven of. And now, because I know that, I'm trying to persuade people to repent. I'm trying to persuade people to make a change. Paul says, I know who he is. I have a fear because of that. And I'm trying to persuade others to have it too. And here's who he is. Here's some things. This could keep on going. Israel didn't know him, taken into captivity. Judah didn't know him, captivity. Pharisees didn't know him, killed his son. One talent man didn't know him, and he's slothful and unprofitable and wicked. The ones who made excuses didn't know him, and because of that, they missed out on the feast of a lifetime. And if me and you don't know him, we're going to be standing before a judge, and we're not going to be ready. Get your songbooks out. Destroyed for lack of knowledge. We can all improve in that. There is room for us all to acknowledge him more, honor and respect him more, come to a better understanding of who he is, what he wants, and what he won't tolerate. There's room for all of us to improve. And we've got a lot of examples that we reminded ourselves of that will hopefully give us the shot in the arm to do just that very thing. You're not a Christian, but you do know how much God loves you. And you know that he showed that love in giving up his son, and his son showed his love through dying. Confess him as your Lord. Confess him as God's son. Repent of your sins. Be baptized to wash away those sins. If you are a Christian, just quit knowing him. Quit acknowledging him, meaning you've stopped making him the authority and Lord of your life. You may have done that. That may be true of how you got here today. That doesn't have to be true of how you go home. You can fix that. He's promised to forgive you, and he will. If you need to do it in a public way, let's do it while we stand and sing.